Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. Today we'll have election results from the major races across East County, as well as state and national election results and analysis. Oh, and if you're feeling jaded about politics after this election, you're not alone, and that's nothing new. We'll have some political humor quotes from famous people throughout history right after our election wrap-up report. If you bought a lottery ticket in East County, you just might be a lot richer. We'll have the winning numbers and details on where it was sold. The county is moving closer to making it easier to keep bees in the backcountry. We'll have the buzz on today's show. Oh, and speaking of buzzing, learn about yellow fever mosquitoes found for the first time in San Diego County, as well as two deaths from West Nile virus that have occurred in East County, also caused by mosquito bites, and what you can do to stay safe. Speaking of safety, a red flag warning for high fire danger is in effect through Thursday of this week. On our Crime Beat report, hear about an arrest made of a man caught on video throwing a dog over a fence in Ramona. Our Green Scene segment will have news about tens of thousands of acres granted wilderness protections in Cleveland National Forest locally. And we'll wrap up today's show with a rerun of our interview with Nathan Fletcher, telling you about his Three Wise Men Foundation to help veterans, with some special events that are coming up this Veterans Day. And we'll also tell you about our winners in this year's San Diego Press Club Awards. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. Today, to help with our post-election wrap-up, I have with me Leon Thompson and Ariel Brook. Ariel and Leon, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam.
Thank you.
Now, this is based on a tally of all the precinct votes and the absentee ballots. However, there are still thousands of provisional ballots remaining to be counted, so it's still possible that some of these close races could flip. We're going to start with a report on what happened at the national level. Nationally, Republicans have won control of the Senate, and they also increased their margin of dominance in the House of Representatives. One of those gains appears to have occurred in San Diego's 52nd congressional district. Former Councilman Carl DeMaio, the Republican, has just 752 votes more than Democratic incumbent Scott Peters. That's a 50.2 to 49.8% margin, folks. It's not yet known whether Scott Peters may request a recount, which is his right under the law with such a narrow margin. In other local races, Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter captured nearly 72% of the votes over challenger James Kimber, a physician assistant in the 50th Congressional District. In the 51st District, Democratic Congressman Juan Vargas scored a solid victory with 68% of the vote over his opponent, Stephen Meade. Two other races were somewhat closer. Congresswoman Susan Davis, a Democrat, fought off a challenge from ex-Navy SEAL Larry Wilski, a Republican. Davis won with 58% of the vote in the 53rd District to Wilski's 42%. Congressman Daryl Issa, a Republican who has drawn national media scrutiny as chair of the House Oversight Committee, held his seat with 58% of the vote over Democratic challenger Dave Pizer, who got 42%. In the DeMaio race, DeMaio may have benefited from national dissatisfaction with Congress and the Obama administration, factors that helped Republicans score victories in a number of national races, picking up actually seven seats in the Senate to gain control of it. Congress has been beset by gridlock for the last 2 years, with House Republicans blocking most administration and Democratic-backed efforts at reforms, while Senate Democrats similarly kept Republicans' key legislation from coming up for a vote. With Republicans now firmly in control of both houses of Congress, the president can veto legislation, though he may be reluctant to do so on omnibus bills such as measures to keep the government funded, and increased compromise is likely to get vital measures approved. The president is not expected to be able to get confirmation for key judicial or cabinet appointments with Republicans running the Senate. Now, as for policy changes, Republicans are likely to work to cut the federal budget, emphasize fiscal responsibility and boost business-friendly tax breaks, as well as continue efforts to repeal or reform the Affordable Health Care Act, or Obamacare. Republicans may also strive to pare back or privatize Social Security and impose restrictions on reproductive rights, including abortion, long stated goals of their party. You can expect climate change action to be pushed to the back burner since the GOP is dominated by climate change deniers. Instead, look to Republicans to seek approval of the Keystone Pipeline and increased oil and gas production domestically, along with renewed emphasis on nuclear power in contrast to the Obama administration's renewable energy emphasis. A thorny issue for Republicans and all members of Congress to grapple with will be how to handle the crisis in Iraq and Syria. A year ago, the vast majority of American voters polled wanted troops withdrawn from Iraq. But after withdrawal, ISIL terrorists seized control of a broad swath of the region, declaring an Islamic State and slaughtering those who refused to convert to Islam. The president launched airstrikes, and some denounced that, while others, including some of the local Republicans, have called for ground troops to be sent into the region. Congress adjourned without voting on a war declaration or whether to lift the immigration cap on persecuted religious minorities seeking to come to America from Iraq. The new Congress will now need to decide how to handle those important issues and others when it convenes in January. Now, next up, we're going to go to Leon, who has an update for us on the outcome of the statewide election races here in California, which was quite different from the national picture.
As the nation turns red, California stays blue with a sweep of statewide offices. A red wave of Republican wins resulted in the party increasing its hold on the House of Representatives and gained formidable control of the U.S. Senate. But as a consolation prize, Democrats were able to keep California in the blue state column by keeping a firm hold in the state's highest offices. Even in the early vote counting, major news organizations projected that voters had granted Governor Jerry Brown a second consecutive four-year term, the fourth in his political career, by a comfortable margin, which did not change throughout the evening. Incumbent Democrat Gavin Newsom was able to stave off a challenge by East County resident and former chairman of the California Republican Party, Ron Nehring. In other statewide races, Democrat Alex Padilla from the 20th District has edged out a slim lead over his Republican challenger for Secretary of State with 100% of the votes counted. After trailing in initial returns, Betty Yee won re-election for state controller, along with Attorney General Kamala D. Harris and Dave Jones for insurance commissioner. Incumbent Democrat Tom Torkelson headed for an early victory for superintendent of public instruction over his rival, Marshall Tuck. Tuck, a fellow Democrat, had advocated for charter schools and vouchers.
Thank you, Leon. Next up, Ariel has the outcome on the statewide ballot initiatives.
Thanks, Miriam. So what was going on in the mind of California voters on Tuesday in voting for the ballot initiatives? They approved new water projects and set aside funds for a rainy day. They voted against allowing the state's insurance commissioner to have authority over insurance rates, also defeated mandatory drug and alcohol testing for medical doctors, and caps on malpractice awards. Voters gave their approval for immediate reduction of criminal sentences for simple drug possession and other property crimes to misdemeanors, but dealt a major blow to the gambling aspirations of three small California Indian tribes by voting down a measure which would allow them to build a casino outside the borders of their reservation. Voters backed, by a wide margin, Proposition 1, which will allow the state of California to issue $7.5 billion in bonds to fund new dams in Central and Northern California, the bond and cleanup and restore much of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, where the state gets a vast portion of its water. It would also fund projects to clean and restore groundwater in Riverside and Los Angeles counties. While most of the state approved the measure, voters in Northern California overwhelmingly expressed opposition to the proposition. The state has not undertaken any significant improvement water projects in the past 50 years. Also passing by a wide margin was Proposition 2, which mandates the state legislature to set aside revenues in a rainy day fund to make California's budget less volatile. Seen as a major modification to the federal government's Affordable Care Act, voters rejected by a wide margin Proposition 45, which would have increased the state's insurance commissioner authority by requiring insurance companies to get approval before raising health care premium rates on consumers. Voters also rejected Proposition 46, which would require drug testing for medical doctors and would have increased the cap on medical malpractice damages. Opposed by some law enforcement and many district attorneys throughout the state, Proposition 47 won approval from voters. The measure will immediately reduce sentences for drug possession and property crimes and reduce the classification of most nonviolent crimes from a felony to a misdemeanor. The measure's proponents said that the net effect would be that it would reduce state prison overcrowding, while its opponents warned that drug and property crimes would increase. Proposition 48, a measure which was vocally opposed by most of the state's Indian tribes, was resoundingly rejected by voters by over 1 million votes, which would have allowed the North Fork Rancheria of Mono Indians and Wayo tribes to construct gambling casinos in California's Central Valley.
Now we have an update on the state Senate and Assembly races. By large margins, legislative candidates representing East County have won their re-election bids. Republican State Senator Joel Anderson beat Democratic challenger Fotios Frank Symbukakis by a 70% to 30% margin in the 38th District. In the 40th State Senate District, where two Democrats were in a runoff due to the top two primary system, incumbent Senator Ben Wesso defeated challenger Rafael Estrada handily. Wesso won re-election despite his arrest for driving under the influence of alcohol not long ago. In the 71st Assembly District, where voters had a choice between two Republican candidates, incumbent Assemblyman Brian Jones clinched his victory over Tony Tiora by a substantial margin. Democratic Assemblywoman Shirley Weber breezed to an easy victory over her independent challenger, George Williams. Weber captured roughly two-thirds of the vote in that race. Former labor leader and Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez had the largest vote tally of the evening, 100% of the votes, since she was running unopposed. Next up, we're going to tell you about some of the hottest races here in East County. Certainly one of the most contentious was the La Mesa mayoral and city council races, and there's been an upset in that race. Mayor Art Madrid, who has led La Mesa for the past 24 years, was unseated by councilman and teacher Mark Rapostathis. With 100% of precincts counted, Rapostathis has received nearly 59% of the vote to Madrid's 41%. In the council race, Bill Baber, a member of the La Mesa Spring Valley School District with strong name recognition, cinched victory with nearly 28% of the vote in the five-man race. He's also an attorney, a political consultant, and a registered lobbyist representing building contractors. Guy McWherter, his running mate, an insurance agent and a political newcomer, also won with 23% of the vote. Baber says he's also pleased with the term limit initiative passing, which puts a ticking clock on every council member, he says. Let's not waste any time. Let's get to work to improve La Mesa. Baber and McWherter defeated Mary England, who drew 20% of the vote, with support largely from downtown merchants. She has served as the Chamber of Commerce president. Patrick Dean, the only Democrat in the race, took 16.5% of the vote, and a majority Democratic registration in the city of La Mesa was not enough to defeat the big money poured into the race by development interests and the Republican political machine. Pete Gregorovic, running as an outsider, finished fifth with about 12% of the vote. As we mentioned, term limits passed by a hefty margin with over two-thirds of the vote, and Prop J, the marijuana initiative, lost by a narrower margin, 55 to 45%. An additional initiative to make the city clerk an appointed, not elected position passed by a narrow margin. The election marks the end of an era in La Mesa where Mayor Madrid, now 80 years old, has led the city as mayor for a quarter of the city's 100 years, also serving for many years on the city council before winning his first mayoral election. He championed efforts to pass a ballot measure raising sales tax that enabled construction of a new library, police, and fire stations, and was the first mayor in the San Diego region to sign the U.S. Mayor's Climate Pledge to take action against climate change at a local level. He also points with pride to La Mesa's high ranking as a walkable city and helped create a Safe Routes to Schools program for children. Those rank among his accomplishments. In recent years, relations between the council and the mayor have grown contentious, and Councilman Rapostathis has said he wants to strive to restore civility and a closer working relationship among council members. He has twice been named Teacher of the Year and also heads up junior theater programs, earning widespread respect in the community. And now Ariel is going to tell us about the outcome in the Lemon Grove races.
Democratic challenger Jennifer Mendoza has ousted incumbent Councilman Howard Cook, a Republican, to increase Democratic control on Lemon Grove's council. Jerry Jones, an incumbent who is also a Democrat, also won re-election. Though officially a nonpartisan race, the political parties threw their weight behind candidates in the race. Chair of the city's planning commissioner, Mendoza is also a paralegal and is a board member of the Soroptimus, Boy Scouts, PTA, and other community groups. She has made street repairs her number one goal if elected. Jones, also a Democrat, had the most votes with 25.2%, followed by Mendoza with 24.5%. Mendoza will join Democrats Raquel Vasquez and Mayor Mary Sesson on the council. Challenger Stephen Brown took 19.3% of the vote, followed by Cook with 19.2%, and Anna Sesson Baker, daughter of Mayor Mary Sesson, had 11.6%.
Over in El Cajon, the incumbents triumphed. Mayor Bill Wells thumped two opponents to win 82% of the vote, getting his reelection handily over Alan Thewini and Jonathan Wright. Councilman Gary Kendrick took over two-thirds of the vote over his opponent, Elwood Alexander. The incumbents had the benefit of an improving economy and new policies, such as the city's outreach to car dealers to bring more revenues into El Cajon, a city that has the county's highest poverty rate. El Cajon's leaders have also had success in healing relations with the city's large Iraqi Chaldean population, with Mayor Wells speaking out publicly in support of bringing persecuted Christian Chaldean refugees to El Cajon. Relations with the Chaldean community had grown strained under former Mayor Mark Lewis after remarks interpreted as racially charged were widely publicized. Mayor Lewis stepped down soon after, citing health reasons. El Cajon has also brought back the spirit of its former Friendship Festival, launching America on Main Street this year to celebrate multiculturalism as well as the city's historical heritage. None of the challengers proved to be formidable in this election, enabling the incumbents to sail to easy victories despite recent controversies over votes to restrict sales of alcohol and e-cigarettes and regulate hookah bars. Kendrick led efforts to pass the deemed approved ordinance limiting single sales of alcohol in an effort to crack down on serial inebriates, but the measure faced opposition from the Neighborhood Market Association, which represents many of those Chaldean merchants. A proposal to raise revenues by leasing the East County Performing Arts Center to the Rock Church for a significant number of days each year also drew controversy and threats of a legal challenge in El Cajon. And now, Leon will bring you the results of the Santee City Council race, which brings a new face to the council out there.
Santee City Council members John Minto and Rob McNellis have won re-election with 26% and 23% of the vote, respectively, with 100% of the precincts counted. But the biggest vote-getter was Ron Hall, who drew 27.39% of the vote to fill a vacant seat on the council. Hall, an insurance broker, is past president and a current board member of the Santee Chamber of Commerce with strong name recognition in the community. Challengers Maggie Acera and Keshav Damore, who ran on reform platforms, drew 15.4% and 8.3% of the vote. Unlike some local cities that are built out, Santee weathered tough economic times with a sound budget due in part to new development, including a sports complex that created new property tax revenues. The fate of remaining undeveloped lands in the city was a key campaign issue, with pending projects including Finita Ranch, a proposed theater complex, and land around the Carlton Hills golf course that recently sold. Acera has called for greater transparency and public input on key issues, while Keshav advocated for policies to help mobile home park owners and the poor.
The biggest political upset in East County this election appears to have taken place in the San Miguel Fire District, where a slate of challengers backed by the Firefighters Union has won three seats on the board, ousting three incumbents. On top, with 100% of precincts counted, are Mike Vacchio, Jim Eck, and Teresa McKenna, with about 20%, 18%, and 16% of the vote, respectively. But incumbent Rick Augustine was close behind McKenna with nearly 16% of the vote, trailing by just 73 votes this morning, with all votes supposedly counted, followed by board members Chris Winter at about 13% and Jeffrey Lyle Nelson at 9%. Cindy Croucher, the wife of former Fire Chief Croucher, came in last with 7%. The hottest point of contention was over the district's partnership with CAL FIRE to run firefighting operations. The move came after budget woes, and it enabled the district to reopen a closed fire station on Dehesa Road, but it meant longer hours and less pay for the firefighters. CAL FIRE and incumbents claimed the partnership has led to other improvements and was the best option for the district to improve safety. But challengers contended that some aspects of public safety had been compromised and argued for more local control. And apparently, voters agreed with the challengers in this race. And now Ariel is going to tell us about another hot race out here, the contest for the Grossmont Union High School District Board.
Thanks, Miriam. Newcomers failed in a bid to win seats on Grossmont High School Board. With 100% of votes counted, incumbents Robert Shield and Jim Kelly won re-election on the Grossmont Union High School District Board with 24.31% and 22.58% of the vote, respectively. Dr. Gary Woods, who lost his seat in the last election and consistently voted in a block with Kelly and Shield, came in third place with 22.2%, a substantial margin, though, over challengers Shirley Anderson with 14.39%, Barbara Stevens with 11.39%, and Steve Mattia with 5.12%. Woods will fill the vacant seat left by Dick Hoy's resignation. The election outcome will solidify control of the Grossmont Union High School District's board by staunch conservative members opposed to building an Alpine High School or backing Alpine parents' wishes to split up the district and unify with the Alpine Union School District. The district is currently embroiled in two lawsuits over its obstructionism on turning over funds from two bond measures into an escrow account to assure funds intended by voters for building a high school in Alpine will be used for that purpose. Anderson and Stevens had backing from the Sequan tribe, which funded independent expenditure mailers and billboards in an effort to unseat Kelly and Shield, who drew the ire of tribal leaders over their refusal to build the long-promised Alpine High School.
In the Helix Water District, the status quo will remain since both incumbents won re-election. Kathleen Hedberg, who has been a consumer champion, retained her seat with two-thirds of the vote, while Deanna Verbecki narrowly won her bid by just 3% over challenger Stephen Rotsar, who had said he was running to reduce water rates. Another local race of interest, Prop P in the Julian Cuyamaca Fire District, failed. That was a bond measure that would have raised money to fund the fire district. This is a district where the public has been fighting the takeover or merger with the county fire authority, and this may force that move since voters failed to approve the bond measure. And speaking of bond measures, school bonds passed handily in Lemon Grove at El Cajon, while some others are still too close to call. Next up, Leon is going to bring us a report about Prop J in La Mesa and some marijuana initiatives around the nation.
The hopes for an ordinance that would allow for medicinal cannabis dispensaries in La Mesa went up in smoke as Proposition J failed in last night's election. A similar measure in Encinitas suffered the same fate. However, the advocates for Proposition J were optimistic last night as they left a poll-watching gathering at Swami's in La Mesa. Senara Velasquez, a public policy advocate, said that nationwide the news was good. The pace of reform is accelerating, she said. A dispensary ordinance in La Mesa would have been a step in the right direction for the greater good of a number of patients who need safe access. Oregon became the latest state to legalize recreational marijuana, meaning pot would be available for purchase legally, provided that the person qualifies as a consenting adult free of a felony criminal record. A similar state law appears on its way to passage in Alaska, where the numbers are too close to call. Decriminalizing marijuana possession in the District of Columbia and the disproportionate application of the law against black people were big issues in the debate. The measure passed with a wide margin but needs congressional approval. Overall, Sonora is looking to 2016 as the presidential election year that will bring legal cannabis to California. She said, the winds of change are with us. The people have let their will be known. Back to you, Miriam.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us with this election wrap-up. And listeners, you can find full returns on all local races at the San Diego Registrar of Voters site. on the statewide races at the Secretary of State's site, and also on East County Magazine. Look for more articles and analysis on additional races coming soon on eastcountymagazine.org.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Ed Barena.
And today, now that the election's over with, we thought it might be worth putting in perspective for those of you who may be disillusioned, disappointed perhaps with some of the results, that this is nothing new. People have been complaining about politics and politicians all the way back to ancient times. The famous humorist from the 1800s, Mark Twain, once said, "Politics and diapers must be changed often, and for the same reason."
More recently, Jay Leno said, "If God wanted us to vote, he would have given us candidates."
There you go. There's a quote that's attributed to someone named Henry Kate the Seventh, and it says, "The problem with political jokes is that they get elected." Now, a little disclaimer here. We looked all over the internet and we couldn't find who Henry Kate was, but we like the quote, so we're including it anyway.
Yep, and here's one most people know pretty well, Aesop. "We hang the petty thieves and appoint the great ones to public office."
There you go. Aesop, who was famed for his fables. Plato, the ancient philosopher, stated, "One of the penalties for refusing to participate in politics is that you end up being governed by your inferiors." So there you go. For those of you that didn't vote, this is all your fault.
All right. And here's one that kind of a unique historical figure, Nikita Khrushchev. "Politicians are the same all over. They promise to build a bridge even where there is no river."
Even bridges to nowhere, Ed. The German author Oskar Ameringer stated, "Politics is the gentle art of getting votes from the poor and campaign funds from the rich by promising to protect each from the other."
And here's one from an actual politician himself, Adlai Stevenson, said, "I offer my opponents a bargain. If they will stop telling lies about us, I will stop telling the truth about them."
Texas Gwinnon was an actress, and she said, "A politician is a fellow who will lay down your life for his country."
My last quote here is from Doug Larson, who is a newspaper editor. It says, "Instead of giving a politician the keys to the city, it might be better to change the locks."
I like that one. And last but not least, George Orwell, the author of the dystopian novel 1984, wrote, "Political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind."
If you bought a Fantasy V California Lottery ticket at the 7-Eleven store at 14110 Old Highway 80 in Flint Springs, just east of El Cajon, you could be instantly rich. A ticket worth nearly $408,000 matches this week's winning numbers of 3, 12, 14, 32, and 34. But the winner has not yet come forward to claim his or her prize. The lucky winner has up to 6 months to turn in the winning ticket and claim the money. This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
The County Board of Supervisors took another step forward in plans to promote beekeeping and agriculture while protecting the public by directing their staff at last week's meeting to begin the final steps in creating a proposed tiered beekeeping ordinance. Here's the buzz. The ordinance is expected to be brought back to the board for a vote in a year. If ultimately approved, it would update current rules and allow hobbyists and commercial beekeepers to keep hives closer to roads, property lines, and homes in the unincorporated areas, but still far enough away to keep people safe. The distance would depend on the size of the operation. Board Chairwoman Diane Jacob brought the idea of updating the county's beekeeping rules to the board last October after talking with beekeepers and the San Diego County Beekeeping Society, who said county regulations were making it tough for beekeepers to prosper. In addition, scientists and beekeepers worldwide have been reporting for years that populations of honeybees, which are essential to agricultural production, have been drastically decreasing. Current county regulations require all beekeepers, small and large, to keep hives 100 feet from roads and 600 feet, or 2 football fields, away from homes. County staff has recommended a new ordinance with 3 levels of distance requirements for beekeepers after working extensively with keepers, the Beekeeping Society, community planning groups, and the San Diego County Farm Bureau. Backyard hobbyists would be allowed generally to keep 2 hives within 25 feet of roads and property lines, 35 feet from neighboring homes, and 150 feet from sensitive sites, such as places where there may be small children, the elderly, confined animals, or those who are physically challenged. Small commercial beekeeping companies would be allowed to have up to 20 hives, and large commercial beekeeping companies would be allowed to have an unlimited number of hives, with larger setback requirements from roads, property lines, and sensitive sites. Hive owners must register as beekeepers and keep only European honeybees, along with following up-to-date beekeeping practices. Supervisors Wednesday also accepted a list of 19 county-owned properties in the unincorporated areas, including parks and preserves, that could become apiaries. Jacob said a key to the board's approving any ordinance would be to include an aggressive enforcement plan that would educate beekeepers, make sure they were following the rules, and remove hives if people violated the rules. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. This is Miriam Raftery with a special announcement from the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts. The National Weather Service has issued a red flag warning for San Diego and East County through Thursday due to Santa Ana winds forecast with gusts up to 55 miles an hour and dry conditions, so folks, please be careful out there.
This is Leon Thompson for East County News Service. A 71-year-old man is believed to have died of West Nile virus, the County of San Diego reports. He is the second local victim of the mosquito-borne disease. The latest patient was reportedly in good health before being bitten by a mosquito in his San Carlos home. Last week, county health officials announced that an elderly Mount Helix resident had also died of the disease in October. Both patients were treated at Grossmont Hospital, but the family of the latest victim is faulting the hospital for failing to test for West Nile virus in a timely manner. His daughter told 10 News that the hospital refused to test Daylock even after being shown a letter from the county health department sent to residents in his neighborhood warning that mosquitoes infected with West Nile virus had been found. The family also reportedly told hospital workers repeatedly that Daylight had been bitten by a mosquito, but said it took more than a week before the hospital agreed to the test. By then it was too late. The county advises residents to report dead birds which carry West Nile virus, remove stagnant water sources, which can be breeding grounds for mosquitoes, and report standing water sources to the county's Department of Environmental Health. This has been Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health report. For the first time, a new invasive mosquito that carries yellow fever has been found in San Diego County. These mosquitoes feed in daylight hours, unlike local mosquitoes, and can transmit several tropical diseases. Military entomologists at Naval Base San Diego discovered four Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, otherwise known as yellow fever mosquitoes, in the last couple of weeks in offices at the base on San Diego Bay. Navy and county vector control teams are putting traps on and around the base to learn if there are more of these mosquitoes, which have also recently been found in Los Angeles County. The mosquito is small and black with white stripes. It differs from native California mosquitoes by being an aggressive pest. Residents are urged to report to the county if mosquitoes are biting in the daytime. The yellow fever mosquito has commonly been found on the East Coast and other places. However, it started showing up in a few California counties in 2013. Officials want to keep it out of our state because it can spread dangerous diseases including yellow fever, chikungunya, and dengue fever, which are currently rare here. Yellow fever, once known as yellow jack and yellow plague, is largely contained to tropical areas of Africa and Latin America nowadays, and there has not been an outbreak in the United States in over 100 years, though it was once a deadly scourge in the American South and in New York. Without treatment, it can kill 50% of those who contract it, causing organ damage, although there is a vaccine that's available in areas where yellow fever is prevalent. Chikungunya is a viral disease that has historically been kept to Africa, Asia, Europe, and other areas. However, it's been spreading in recent years. This year, two travelers brought it home to San Diego County, and in Florida, over 100 cases have been reported, including the first two ever acquired in the United States. Chikungunya symptoms include fever and severe joint pain, often in the hands and feet, and can include headache, muscle pain, joint swelling, and a rash. It's rarely fatal, but there is no vaccine or medication for it. Dengue fever is also still rare, but has been seen here on a yearly basis. San Diego County Department of Health and Human Services statistics report that a dozen people in San Diego got sick from dengue fever in the last 2 years after they contracted it while visiting other countries. Dengue disease and the more severe dengue hemorrhagic fever are caused by viruses carried by the yellow fever mosquito. Dengue hemorrhagic fever can be fatal, and there is no vaccine or cure. Symptoms include sudden onset of fever, headache, pain behind the eyes, joint pain, muscle and bone pain, rash, and bleeding. Prevent mosquito breeding by getting rid of items that can hold standing water, such as plant saucers, toys, and old tires, and dumping out rain gutters. You can get free mosquito fish from the county that will eat mosquitoes in swimming pools, ponds, fountains, and horse troughs. Protect yourself by wearing long sleeves and pants when outdoors. Use insect repellent containing DEET or other appropriate ingredients when outside. Make sure screens on windows and doors are in good condition and secured to keep the insects out. County environmental health officials urge the public to eliminate and report any standing water that could be breeding grounds for these mosquitoes, not only outdoors but also inside homes, because these mosquitoes can actually breed indoors. Report green swimming pools or other standing water sources to the County Vector Control Program at 858-694-2888 or email vector@sdcounty.ca.gov. You can also anonymously report neglected pools by downloading the county's Fight the Bite app for your phone.
Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ariel Brook. A man caught on video in Ramona has been identified and charged with one misdemeanor count each of animal cruelty and animal abandonment after throwing a dog over a fence. Gary Sartor of Ramona faces up to 6 months in county jail or a fine of up to $1,000 for each violation. Video surveillance cameras at a property in the 1100 block of D Street in Ramona captured an unidentified man tossing a young pit bull over a six-foot-high gate at a commercial building on August 28th, then walking away. The dog was found the following day by the business owner and turned over to County Animal Services in Carlsbad. Animal Services asked for help in identifying the suspect on the video, and one of the tips called into the department on September 28th led to the suspect. An animal control officer interviewed the suspect and determined there were grounds to submit the case to the district attorney's office, which charged Sartor with the two misdemeanors. The dog, a black and white mixed breed, was examined by veterinary staff after the incident and no injuries were found. The six-month-old puppy, named Dolly by the department staff, was put up for adoption September 23rd, and she went home with the new owner the same day. Animal Services recommends that if an owner is unable to continue to care for a pet, that he or she reach out to rescue groups or bring the pet to a local animal shelter for placement into an adoption program.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine's Green Scene Report. U.S. Forest Service officials have signed a record of decision for the Cleveland National Forest Land Management Plan Amendment that gives wilderness protection to an additional 43,000 acres in the forest. The decision is part of a settlement agreement approved in 2011 following a lawsuit filed by California's resources agencies against the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Center for Biological Diversity, challenging a forest land management plan that had been approved in 2006. Will Metz, supervisor of Cleveland National Forest, calls the decision a monumental moment that will have major implications. He adds, the forest now has new areas managed as wilderness, which is the highest level of protection that the federal service can provide, and especially important is in this highly developed region. Roughly 43,000 more acres of the Cleveland National Forest are now zoned as recommended wilderness and will therefore be managed to retain and improve their wilderness character until Congress makes a final decision about their wilderness designation. These lands are located primarily on the Palomar Ranger District, but also include northern portions of the Descanso Ranger District. This decision also amends the land management plan monitoring and evaluation requirements to make them more efficient and effective. According to a press release issued by the United States Forest Service, the areas now zoned as recommended wilderness offer outstanding opportunities for solitude, primitive recreation, species refuge, and watershed protection, as well as manageable boundaries that avoid conflicts with existing roads and adjacent uses. The majority of the forest will continue to have the flexibility to accommodate a range of uses such as mountain biking, hang gliding, or utility corridors that are not permitted in designated wilderness areas.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. My very special guest today is Nathan Fletcher, our former San Diego Assemblyman and a military veteran. Welcome to the show, Nathan.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Now, our topic today is a special foundation that Nathan has started called Three Wise Men Foundation, and its specific purpose is to help returning combat veterans. And this has a very special meaning for Nathan, and I'd like you to tell our listeners about why you started the foundation, what inspired it.
You know, when I was a boy growing up, it was me and my little brother, and our closest friends were our cousins, our three cousins. Jeremy Wise, Ben Wise, and Bo Wise, three brothers, and the last name was Wise. We always called them the three wise men. And we did everything that kids did together. I mean, Jeremy and I were the same age, and Ben and my younger brother were about the same age, and then baby Bo, the third wise man, he was the little one. And we grew up, and we were friends, and we were really close, and we all kind of went through life together. You know, yeah. We finished grade school together. We finished high school together. We got married around the same time. We had families around the same time. We all joined the military.
Very patriotic family. All of you served overseas.
All served.
All in combat duty.
All in combat duty. I went first in the Marines. Jeremy became a Navy SEAL. Ben joined the Army. He was a Green Beret. My little brother flies fighter pilots in the Navy. And Bo joined the Marines. So he finished strong with the Marine Corps. And I was talking to my brother this morning, actually, and we were adding up days. And collectively, between the five of us, we think we did about 2,500 days in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Wow, that's amazing.
Just our family. But tragically, December 30th of 2009, we lost Jeremy. He was killed by a suicide bomber in Afghanistan. Just over 2 years later, January 15th of 2012, we lost Ben, who was also killed in Afghanistan. And so the Three Wise Men Foundation really is recognizing the sacrifice that so many American families have made and honoring the memory of Jeremy and Ben, but really focusing on Bo. Because Bo's the one who survived, and he made it back.
And is he still overseas?
No. He's in the Marine Corps. He is permanently non-deployable. He's kind of, if you've ever seen Saving Private Ryan,
I wondered about that. If you've had brothers in the same family already killed, don't they have a limit on...
They won't let you deploy. So he can still serve, but he can never leave the States. But, you know, Bo struggles. He struggles with the surviving combat, with the legacy of combat, with the impact of combat. And much the same way that tens of thousands of veterans struggle every day. And we see veterans' unemployment rates that are high. We see veterans' suicide rate. Between 22 and 50 veterans a day commit suicide in America.
Staggering, absolutely.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
It is. Do you think the long deployments we've seen in these wars may have something to do with that? I guess in prior wars, people would go over and serve a tour of duty and be back. And some of these guys are on 4, 5, 6 tours of duty now because the wars have gone on for a decade.
Well, and you know, a lot of folks don't realize that Iraq and Afghanistan are both the longest wars, 1 and 2, the longest wars in the history of our country.
Yeah.
We've never had conflicts that went longer. And I think it's a combination of things. I think it's the longest wars. I think it's repeated deployments. Mm-hmm. What we also see is we see, although we have fewer troops serving than we had in previous wars, the same ones keep going repeatedly over and over and over again. And I think because in previous generations, about 10% of the American public had served. Mm-hmm. It's now about 1%. And so I think that there's a little bit less understanding in the military, yeah. A little bit less acceptance. It's not that people don't want to help, but we don't see the help and assistance that we should.
You have that close tie as if it's somebody in your own family.
In your own family, right.
Like you. Yeah, we also, with long deployments like that, I think we're more apt to see problems like PTSD, mm-hmm. some of that. And the other thing is that thanks to the advances in medical science, it's kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's wonderful that many people are now surviving injuries that would have killed soldiers a generation ago. And yet, that also means more of them are coming back with brain injuries, with
multiple amputations. I think this is a huge point, and this is a hugely important but often underreported fact. Mm-hmm. The reality is, statistically, you're just as likely to get wounded in Iraq or Afghanistan as you were in any preceding war. Mm-hmm. So the danger level is basically the same. But the probability of you dying is exponentially lower because of just that, advances right. in body armor, advances in flight surgery. And so you have veterans who, right to your point, which is so right on, they're surviving things that people have never survived before.
And, I mean, in your experience, to what degree are they getting or not getting the help that they need when they come back, whether they're injured, whether it's an issue of PTSD, depression, or simply needing a job, needing some training, needing some help to readjust to civilian life?
I mean, they're clearly not getting it. And if they were getting the help and treatment they needed, we wouldn't have between 22 and 50 committing suicide. We wouldn't have an unemployment rate above veterans that is higher than that of the civilian population.
Right.
We wouldn't have a VA scandal where we just saw veterans who were on waiting lists for years. And and all these veterans are doing, all they're asking for, is the care and treatment for their injuries and their effects sustained while in combat. And if we have the money to go to war, then we have the money to take care of them when they come back. And if we have the moral authority to send young men and women to war, we have the moral obligation to care for them when they come back. And so it is frustrating to see, a lot of things. And I know that people say, well, we're trying hard, it's getting better. Well, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. Yeah. 10 years ago, you made a conscious decision to go to war. And simultaneous with that decision, you need to make a conscious decision to take care of them. And so what we're trying to do is, and we can't, I've often said, we can't single-handedly fix the problems of the VA.
Yeah, but what are some of the issues?
But we can help.
Foundation.
Yeah, we can help. So in the last few years, I've talked to a lot of leaders in the veteran community, and I've said, hey, where are the gaps? What could be done? How can we have a positive impact and do good? And a number of things came. They said, one, they said, you can help us raise awareness of the problem. They said, mm-hmm. a lot of people aren't aware of the problem that veterans are facing when they come back. And they said, raising the consciousness and the awareness is good. And so we're doing that. The second thing is veterans are hard to reach. And so when they leave active duty military, there's not a list, they don't check in, they don't do these types of things. And so that was why by partnering with the CrossFit community and with the workout community, we think that we have an avenue to reach these veterans directly with a message that says, we love you, we care about you, you fought for our country, now we need you to fight to survive the peace. You fought to survive combat, now we need you to fight to survive the peace, and it's okay to ask for help.
Very good. So what are some of the things specifically that your foundation is doing
yep.
to help the veterans?
So our initial focus surrounds Veterans Day. So what we're aiming to do is create a national movement. We have what's called the Three Wise Men Tribute. And it's a workout event where we reach out to veterans and the CrossFit community to come together on Veterans Day and host a Three Wise Men Tribute. It's a specific workout to honor Jeremy, Ben, and focus on Bo. Mm-hmm. And the proceeds of that effort will go directly to organizations that are providing support for veterans.
Very good.
So we're highlighting the Navy SEAL Foundation, the Green Beret Association, Semper Fi Fund, and locally here, Courage to Call 211. And so we're doing that, and we're kicking that off. That'll take place on Veterans Day, which is in November. But we're kicking that off on October 18th with a big event on the deck of the USS Midway, the inaugural Three Wise Men Tribute, where we'll unveil the workout. We'll have fans cheering. We'll have competitors. We'll have average folks doing the workout. We'll have some professional athletes coming in and doing it.
Very
and that'll
exciting.
Be on October 18th on the Midway.
Now, you say it's a national event. Will there also be any out here in East County or other parts of San Diego?
Oh, there'll be all over. And so what we're doing is we're signing up. Any CrossFit affiliate can go to our website at threewisemantribute.org mm-hmm. And register to host an event for free. There's no cost. We'll provide some supporting materials. And so if you work out at a CrossFit location, if you own a CrossFit location, you know, encourage, you know, your folks to let them know that there's an opportunity to sign up to participate for free. All they have to do is go to Three Wise Men Tribute, register their location, and then we'll send them the materials.
Very good. And then if a member of the public wishes to participate in this, can they sign up on the site as well?
They absolutely can. They go to the same site, threewisementribute.org, and they can join us on the deck of the Midway. Mm-hmm. They can come participate there. They can either do the workout or spectate, or they can find a local location in their area that's hosting one, and they can participate there as well.
Very good. And how does the fundraising component of that come in? Do people get sponsors? Do the gyms put in the funding to help the veterans, or what?
Yeah, so the gyms can kind of organize their own kind of fundraising effort to support a local organization supporting veterans. Or they can join in and register through our site, and then the proceeds of everything we raise will go directly to those organizations. We didn't want to replicate. There's so many organizations that are doing so much good. We wanted to try and provide direct support to them as opposed to trying to just replicate what a lot of good groups are already doing.
Very good. Well, it sounds like a wonderful cause, Nathan, and I'm sure that veterans and their families across America will have a lot to be grateful for these efforts. Listeners, again, that website, if you want to join in, is
threewisementribute.org.
Very good. And we'll also have additional information on our site, eastcountymagazine.org, as we find out about any events that are scheduled coming up in East County this Veterans Day. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate it.
East County Magazine picked up 11 more awards in San Diego Press Club's 2014 Excellence in Journalism Awards on October 28th, bringing our total to 80 journalism awards since our launch in 2008. This year's awards include winners in the following categories: breaking news, environment, general news, investigative reporting, political and government, public service and consumer advocacy, criminal justice, health and medicine, radio special reporting, and radio feature categories. East County Magazine editor and radio show producer Miriam Raftery said she is pleased at this recognition from San Diego Press Club for our dedicated team of reporters, photographers, and broadcast journalists. Our team includes interns, citizen volunteers, and media professionals who have all worked hard to provide news in the public interest. Out of the Ashes, our special radio report on the 10th anniversary of the Cedar Fire, which aired on KNSJ and was produced by Miriam Raftery, received a first place award for specialty reporting. This special report had previously also won first place in the Society of Professional Journalists competition. Leon Thompson received a first place Integrated Media Award in the Health and Medicine category for his report, A Hearty Recovery, documenting his own recovery from open heart surgery on our radio show and news website. Our intern, Jessica Richmond, received a first place award for environmental reporting in the Daily Newspapers and Websites category for her article titled, An Ecological Disaster in the Making, examining the history and impacts of major energy products here in East County. She also shared a third-place award with editor Miriam Raftery in the criminal justice category for a story titled, Sheriff Response Times in Rural Areas Raise Concerns. Tom and Nadine Abbott's coverage of the Chariot Fire on Mount Laguna earned a third-place award for breaking news with a story titled, Historic Lodge at Shrine Camp, Sierra Club's Foster Lodge Cabin Among 108 Buildings Destroyed in Chariot Fire. Nadine Abbott also took a second-place award in the general news category for her story, Six States' Ballot Initiative Effort Seeks to Split California. East County Magazine editor Miriam Raftery won several awards, including several shared with other staff members. In addition to those already mentioned, Raftery won second place for environmental reporting with a story titled, Soy Tech Fails to Disclose Truth About Impacts of Solar Projects. She picked up another second-place award for public service and consumer advocacy for a story titled, Why is County Veterans Services Ignoring Rural East County Vets? That story resulted in passage of a measure by county supervisors to bring veterans services to rural libraries. Raftery won a third-place investigative reporting award for her article titled, Was It Fraud? Experts Raise Serious Questions After Low First-Year Energy Production at Ocotillo Wind. In addition, she took third place in the political and government category for her coverage of events that led to the resignation of El Cajon's mayor, with an article titled, Mayor Lewis in Controversy Over Comments on Chaldeans. And last but not least, Mark and Cody Clement shared a third place radio feature award for their entertaining Wildest Jobs interview with a rodeo clown in Lakeside, which aired here on East County Magazine's radio show on KNSJ. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, this is Ed Barena.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
This is Ed Barreno with the Health Alert. The maker of the Esure birth control device has covered up evidence that patients have been seriously harmed by the product for over a decade, ABC News reports. The device consists of metal coils implanted inside a woman's fallopian tubes to provide permanent birth control, but the coils have punctured fallopian tubes in some women, also causing miscarriages and other serious problems. 91 women had to undergo hysterectomies to remove the reproductive organs. In others, the devices caused ectopic pregnancy, a potentially life-threatening condition in which a fertilized egg implants inside a fallopian tube instead of the womb. The device has also been known to migrate out of the fallopian tubes, causing other damage, including bowel perforation. One woman said it felt like her insides were being shredded and that she was in constant pain. Pelvic pain, along with bloating and rashes, are common complaints among women who have had the Esure device implanted. At least one death has occurred in a woman who suffered a strep infection that destroyed her reproductive organs after the device was implanted. The device has also been linked to serious harm in women with allergies to nickel. Conceptus, which made the device until the company recently sold to Bayer, was cited multiple times by the Food and Drug Administration for failing to report complaints. Thousands of complaints have occurred through the years, even triggering a congressional hearing where women called for the device to be banned from the market. Of those, 168 complaints received by the company since 2007 were regarding perforations and other serious problems, yet Conceptus only told the FDA about 22 of those complaints. A Facebook page has now attracted over 3,000 women describing their negative experiences with the device, and Aaron Brockovich, the activist who won a major lawsuit over the poisoning of a town's water supply, has joined the fight to protect women from Esure, setting up a website for women harmed by Esure to tell their stories. Women harmed by the Esure device can't sue the manufacturer since an FDA rule prohibits lawsuits, even though Conceptus covered up how many patients were seriously harmed. Conceptus sold to Bayer Healthcare in June 2013. Bayer has not received any notices of reporting violations from the FDA. Bayer has said that it takes all adverse events seriously, but that most of the side effects are listed in the product's instructions provided to patients. Other than improving its reporting of adverse effects, has Bayer taken any steps to actually make the device safer? ABC News sought to obtain more details, but records obtained from the FDA were blacked out. The TV network is appealing those redactions. But at least for now, it's buyer beware for women who use the Esure birth control devices.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barreno, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.